Well, tonight on Coast to Coast, we have two very important researchers for you. Robert Bovall, he's been on the program before, and Dr. Thomas Brophy. They have teamed together to write Black Genesis, the prehistoric African origins of ancient Egypt. And there's so much to talk about. They're both very accomplished researchers. And we'll be back with both Robert Bovall and Dr. Thomas Brophy in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, a couple of guests for you this hour. And next, and the next after, Robert Bovall, born in Egypt in 1948. In 1989, he published a study which proposed that the layout of the three Giza pyramids and their relative position to the Nile was intended to mirror the layout of the three stars in the Orion's belt and that their relative position to the Milky Way. This thesis is now known as the Orion correlation theory. And also Dr. Thomas Brophy with us tonight. Dr. Thomas Brophy is an astrophysicist who worked with NASA, including as a member of the Voyager 2 spacecraft instrument teams. He's the author of several books and numerous published articles in scientific journals. Here's Dr. Thomas Brophy as well. Robert, welcome to the show again.
Yeah, hi, George. It's nice to be on your show again.
Good to have you with us, and Dr. Thomas Brophy is with us. Hello, doctor.
Hi, George. Nice to be on with you.
Looking forward to this. Robert, for those don't have the benefit of knowing who you are, you've been on many times, but new listeners, tell us a little bit about Robert Bovall.
Well, Robert Bovall at the moment is in southern Spain. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning here. As you rightly said, I was born in Egypt in 1948, and I left Egypt in 67 to go and settle in England, where I completed my studies and graduated as a construction engineer. I went working for quite a few years in the Middle East and Africa. And to cut a long story short, in 1984, I came up with the what you mentioned in the introduction. I came up with the Orion correlation theory, which was eventually published in a book form in 1994. And since then, I've pursued the same line of study. I've written seven books on the topic. On ancient Egypt, and now I've teamed up with my very good friend and colleague, Dr. Thomas Brophy, and we've come up with Black Genesis.
And tell me how this relationship with an astrophysicist got underway.
That's very interesting because, as you probably know, George, I am one of the bad boys of the academic circle with the Orion correlation theory, which has kind of shaken up the Egyptological and archaeological world. Tom and I met, let me get this right, Tom, it was 2003, I think so,
yeah,
in San Diego. We got together because, in fact, Tom was the first academic and scientist who got interested in the Orion correlation theory, and he will tell you his own story in a minute, of course.
Right.
And it was kind of interesting for the, in a sense, for the opposing team to get together. As you know, myself and Graham Hancock and John West and Robert Schock formed a kind of horsemen of the apocalypse for the academics for a while. And it was very interesting to see what a scientist like Tom felt about all this. And we hit it immediately. I mean, and we realized that we were studying the same topic, which, again, Tom will elaborate on this. We were both looking at the Napta Playa mystery, these ancient megalithic stones that we found in the Sahara. And one thing led to another, and we decided we'll research together and come up with this book.
Okay, let's go to you, Dr. Brophy. Tell us a little bit about your background and your relationship with Robert.
Okay, sure. Well, right now I'm here in San Diego, California, and I did my PhD work at the University of Colorado in planetary astrophysics, as you mentioned, working with spacecraft data of the planets and interpreting them and doing dynamical modeling and celestial mechanics related calculations. And through a sort of circuitous loop, that's what brought me back to, or onward to this archaeoastronomy that I'm collaborating with Robert on now. And that path also took me through moving my focus from planetary astrophysics and physics that my degree was in, more into what you might call integral philosophy or integral developmental theory. And I moved to a sort of experimental small graduate school that I was administering here in California, and also wrote my first book titled The Mechanism Demands of Mysticism on this topic of how modern physics might be reopened to the sort of ancient spiritual tradition view of the world. And in that process, a later research topic came up for me, research project. I decided to test Robert's Orion correlation theory, because I had sort of the mathematical tools to do the calculations myself. And also, from my experience in academic science and, you know, publishing peer-reviewed articles and being a peer review referee myself sometimes, I had experienced that in all areas of science, there can tend to be this sort of gang mentality where you have a mindset around some a little theory or that's supposed to be the standard model, and it's really hard to change or to even get a word in that's kind of beyond the mindset. So I had sympathy towards the struggles that Robert was having, sort of natural sympathy in that direction.
And they were dramatic. And by the way, I've got to ask you, Tom, about today's planetary discovery of 5 to 7 planets in a solar system and a sun and everything else. That's pretty dramatic, isn't it, for an astrophysicist? That's exciting.
I heard about that. It sounds fantastic. Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing the details. I think there's a press conference later this week.
There's a press conference on Thursday. May not be related to this discovery, so we'll find out. Robert, in your first book, The Orion Mystery, which came out in 1994, let's talk a little bit about the specifics of what you went through that came up with that theory that, you know what, these pyramids are laid out like the stars in Orion's belt. How'd that all happen?
I'll be brief because it's a long story. But I was working at the time in 1983. I was working in Saudi Arabia. And I took a trip to Egypt to visit my family. My mother was still living there. And while I was in Cairo, on my way to Alexandria, I went to the Cairo Museum, and as fate would have it, I was carrying a camera with me. In those days, you could take pictures inside the museum, not so these days.
Yeah, they've locked that out now, haven't they?
Yeah, it's our good friend, Dr. Hawass. We'll talk about him later, George.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, there was I in the museum with my Olympus OM-1 camera, for those interested. And I went in a room where they had the artifacts of the pyramid builders. And on the wall was a photograph, an aerial photograph of the Giza Necropolis, of the pyramids of Giza. It was a direct overhead picture. And it was the first time I ever saw an overhead picture. I must say, in 1983, the world was very different. We didn't have Google Earth and satellite photography and so forth. It was not so common to see this kind of aerial photography. And it was the first time that it struck me, surprisingly, because I had seen maps of the pyramids before, but seeing them on a photograph, it struck me that I was looking at what was clearly a plan. There are three pyramids, two of almost equal size, the Great Pyramid and the Second Pyramid. And the Third Pyramid, the smallest, was offset from a diagonal that passed through the two largest. It was offset to the left or the east. And it's one of those things, you know, I always describe it as, I don't know if you have this experience, George, by being in a dinner party and sitting at the table, and across the room there's a painting on the wall that is skew width. and this, yeah. This terrible urge to sort of stand up and put it straight.
All the time, Robert.
Well, it's a kind of thing we all have. We want to see things in straight lines and neat. In any case, there it was, this offset kind of stuck in my mind. It just didn't make sense. And I snapped a photograph with my camera and went back to Saudi Arabia where I was working. And there I invited a group of friends to look at this photograph. Now, I was working in the construction field, so there was many specialists, architects, engineers, surveyors, technicians. And all of them looked at this photograph and were all convinced, like I was, that there was a plan. The only thing they couldn't understand is, what did it mean? Why was the third pyramid smaller and offset? And with that kind of almost obsessive thought in my mind, I was camping in the desert. Now, I had, again by fluke, brought with me from Egypt a kind of coffee table book with lovely pictures of the pyramids and so forth. And there was a photograph of the so-called pyramid texts. I'll talk about these later as we go along.
Sure.
And there was a passage from these pyramid texts that mentioned that the king, after his death, would travel to the stars and join the god Osiris in the constellation of Orion. Now, with these thoughts stuck in my mind, there am I in the desert at night with a friend of mine who happened to be a navigator, and he pointed at the constellation, which is one of those things, you know. I hadn't bothered to look at the constellation, and there it was in the sky, nice and bright. It's very bright, by the way, in the morning now at this time of year. And he pointed at the three stars of Orion's belt and said, here are the stars of Orion's belt, and we use them for navigation because they rise due east.
Uh-huh.
As you can see, they're in a row. And then in an afterthought, he said, well, the little one at the top is offset to the left. And the penny dropped in my mind. I mean, it was one of those moments, you know, sort of eureka moments.
Bingo, right?
Bingo, because I immediately went back home and checked the maps and checked photographs, and I plucked courage to write to various professors. And I got a reply from Professor Edwards, the late Professor Edwards, who was curator at the British Museum, who was very intrigued by this suggestion and let me know that there was, in fact, something else that I should have taken into account. There was a shaft inside the Great Pyramid that actually pointed to these stars of Orion's belt. So to me, the whole thing clinched. And one thing led to another, and like we were saying earlier, I eventually published this in an article in 89, and then it went in a book form in 94. And it's been the subject of, I've lost count of several documentaries since. So there you are. That's the background.
Super. Let's go over to Dr. Thomas Brophy for a moment. Doctor, as a specialty, your early specialty was being a planetary astrophysicist. But you're not doing that anymore, are you?
No, I've moved back now.
Why? Why'd you change?
Well, as I mentioned, actually, my interest, research interest, academic interest, shifted focus from pure physical science to include what I call integral philosophy or integral theory. And the reason, though, is a sort of continuity in the sense that the reason I originally went into physics was because of wanting to
wanting to know, learn about how things work is the way to put it. And after you get through a physics program, you get a lot out of it, and it's a fantastic training in critical thinking. But even fundamental physics, we now know, especially in modern physics, describes only a part of the universe. So my fundamental interest to know how things work as a whole, totally, you do have to include physics as fundamental physics as one aspect of that, but then integral philosophy or an inclusive philosophy for the other aspects that aren't covered by physics.
These ancients obviously had an astounding ability with astronomy. How'd they know this stuff?
That's a fantastic question. That's a great question. And there's sort of two approaches to addressing that question. One is it's still controversial as to how much they really knew, especially when we're looking at these very ancient sites. You know, they're prehistoric before writing. So to try to actually prove a sophisticated amount of knowledge is difficult, even if it seems clear sometimes from the monuments themselves. And then the other track is that, as Robert and I experienced in our expedition to the deep desert while we were investigating these things, when you're out there, when you're living in the elements, especially that region, you're just confronted with the sky, the night sky, so obviously, and it's clearly going to be an enormous part of the lives and cultures of the people of those times. So
it pops right out, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And so it's in a sense natural that they were keenly interested in developing models, you know, ideas, concepts about the universe that they were observing. And then it's clearly going to be used for the everyday lives.
All right, and Robert, you know, when you were putting this work together with Thomas, and we'll get into the Black Genesis because that's an interesting part of all these theories. When you looked at these cultures that were out there, how old do you think they are? You know, we've heard the pyramids are 5,000 years old, 10,000 years old. What do you think?
Very good question, George. Black Genesis is going to shake the apple tree, as one says. The reason being is that when I wrote The Message of the Sphinx with Graham Hancock, we used two hard sciences. There were two schools of thought going on in parallel. There was the work of Robert Schock and John West, which argued that the Sphinx, the Great Sphinx of Giza, was a much, much older monument than previously believed by the Egyptologists on the basis of geology. They made a very cogent argument based on the erosion of the Sphinx and on the enclosure wall of the Sphinx, that it was done by precipitated rainwater, which did not occur in that part of the world before the breaking, or rather after the breaking of the Ice Age. And so there was one hard science coming up with a much older date for the Sphinx. And Graham Hancock and I came with the astronomical argument.
Let's get into that, Robert, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest, Robert Bovall, co-authored a very fascinating book with Dr. Thomas Brophy, Black Genesis. We'll get into that as well and find out the age of the pyramids, according to Robert, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Robert Bovall. Robert, you're talking about the age of the pyramids, the age of the Sphinx, and then when the break goddess. So let's get back into that. There's been talk that it could be 5,000 or 10,000 years old, and you're right. The Sphinx does show some water erosion, doesn't it?
It does show a lot of water erosion. Let me go through this carefully, because I think it's important for the listeners to to understand the battle that's been going on for the last 10 years or so, the so-called Battle of the Age of the Sphinx. It all started with John West, John Anthony West, the American author, who had read a book by Schwaller de Lubitz, where Lubitz mentioned that the erosion that was visible on the enclosure wall of the Sphinx. Now, I think it needs to be made clear. The Sphinx is not actually a built monument. It's actually carved in the living rock.
Which was, you know, the whatever it was, this huge edifice of stone was there, and they shaped it, right?
Yes. Well, let's describe the scene sometime in the distant past. There was an outcrop of rock, which today is the head of the Sphinx. And they dug around that outcrop and exposed a much larger piece of natural rock, which they fashioned in the body of a lion. So the Sphinx, in a sense, is inside a pit or an enclosure. It's a kind of shoe-shaped pit. Mm-hmm. And it is on the wall of this enclosure that are very visible horizontal erosions and vertical erosions. Now, Schwaller de Lubitz was mentioning the horizontal erosion and kind of suggested that it might have been the Nile water that perhaps reached during the flood time. I'll be talking about the flood time in a short while. And that water eroded the sides of the wall, and therefore it might have been much older, because the flood waters did not reach in known history, but might have reached in prehistory. What John West did was to take on this suggestion and sort of went trooping around the various universities. He was sort of poo-pooed and shooed away several times, but as fate would have it, he stumbled on Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Schock of Boston University, a geologist, who took an interest and actually went to Egypt. And what Schock immediately realized, being a geologist, was that it wasn't so much the horizontal erosions that were important, because these were obviously made by wind. Water does not do horizontal erosions, certainly not of the kind that we saw on the wall. But what he noticed, that there were very prominent vertical fissures that clearly were made by water flowing down the enclosure walls. And to cut a long story short, through his geological analysis, he concluded that whatever the age of the Sphinx was, it was not 2,500 BC, as the Egyptologists maintained, simply because the erosion that was analyzed by him required a much, much longer period to manage these deep cuts that he investigated. And of course, it fitted the climatic models that we now know, which gave a kind of rough range for the age of the Sphinx from 5,000 to 6,000 BC. So that was a few millennia earlier than the established dates. Later on, Graham Hancock and I came on the scene, and I had proposed in my first book that the layout of the three pyramids were not just mimicking the layout of Orion's belt, but they did so at a very, very unusual time. The reasoning behind this was that the ancient Egyptians spoke of a beginning. They have a term for it. They call it Tep Zepi. It literally means the first time. And they believe that the god Osiris, who was identified to the constellation of Orion, had come in this period of the first time and established civilization. So the reasoning was, well, could we use the stars to establish this first time? And of course, this brought us to the phenomena of the precession of the equinoxes. The precession of the equinox, very simply, is that the Earth, we know that the Earth wobbles in a very, very slow cycle of 26,000 years, and this causes the stars to appear at different heights, at different altitudes, and at different angles through that cycle of 26,000 years.
Okay.
Now, the cycle has a beginning and an end, because if one measures it at the at a certain point, which is the south meridian, or if one measures the Orion belts, it would appear to slide up and down like a pendulum moving vertically over a period of 13,000 years downwards and 13,000 years upwards. We looked at the beginning, or the lowest point, and that was the perfect fit, the kind of Cinderella fit of archaeology. The layout of the pyramids fitted precisely with the pattern of the sky. Now, here is the weird thing. When this occurred, the sunrise would be exactly at the vernal equinox, at the spring equinox, in direct alignment with the Sphinx. That was already a startling discovery, but as we looked at the stars that were behind the sun, one can do that with computers these days,
sure.
We realized that the constellation that was right behind the sun was the constellation of Leo.
Mm-hmm.
And that to us clinched it. We had a kind of model of the sky that fitted, like I said, like a Cinderella shoe, at precisely 10,500 BC. And that brought in the science of astronomy in conjunction with the science of geology to confront the Egyptologists with these two hard sciences. And they've been debating ever since.
Why is it so controversial, Robert? I mean, why can't they say, well, maybe it is much older? So, you know, why do they get so upset?
Your guess is as good as mine, George. I mean, well, okay. The fact is that they... You know, Egyptology has been going on for the last 150 years or so. And we have established, or rather Egyptologists have established a chronology for Egypt. And, you know, this theory is, if indeed they're correct, would totally change the whole established view. We will have to push the Egyptian civilization several thousand years backwards, and they're not going to do it.
No, Zahi's not going to do that. That's for sure. Huh?
Yeah, well, Zahi will have, you know, many things were obstructed by the orthodoxy throughout history. And, you know, it's in many ways, it's understandable. I mean, they're not going to sort of change every textbook simply because there's a new theory. But if the theory sustains itself and undergoes the rigorous criticism that it's been going through, like I said, over the last 10 years, then, you know, the orthodoxy has to change. And we're kind of reaching that point, as you will see with Black Genesis.
Absolutely, and so many things to cover with you tonight. Why is it that it appears that this controversy of the pyramids is so widespread, yet at the same time, whenever we hear the word of the pyramids and the Sphinx, it just captivates us, Robert. Why is that?
I remember something that the late Professor Edwards, the ex-curator of the British Museum, said to me once in private. I can say that now because he's passed away, but I think he wouldn't have minded. He said to me, there's something very strange, Robert. I've been studying the pyramids for 70 years, and I believe there's a little pyramid in everybody's brain. Of course, he said it metaphorically, but it's true. Anything that is discovered related to the Great Pyramid or the Sphinx grabs the imagination of the public. It's one of those monuments of the past that looms literally as a giant question mark. It's just simply the the personification of mystery. You know, when one looks at the Great Pyramid, and believe me, I've looked at this monument for many, many years. I remember the last interview we did, George, was in a couple of years ago, was
couple
it?
Of, yeah, 2008, I think.
2008, that's right. Well, at the time, I was living in Egypt, if you recall, and I had an apartment literally across the Great Pyramid. I would go out on my balcony, and there it was. I could almost touch it. And it's one of those structures that no matter how many times you see it, no many times you ponder on it, it's just baffling. It's as if it shouldn't be there.
Yeah,
it's one of those things that... And of course, it stirs the imagination. And there isn't one human being I know who doesn't know about the Great Pyramid, who's never heard about the Great Pyramid. I mean, there are many monuments around the world that sometimes you think, you know, I've never heard of them, you know. But the Great Pyramid is a universal icon. And that explains why every time there is something, and there is, by the way, lots of things going on. There is an announcement that was made lately. You should ask me this later on. That they're going to try and open these famous little doors again.
Oh, they got a little robot again, right? They're working on a robot?
Yes. As you know, this in 93, a German engineer, Rudolf Ganterbrück, explored the so-called shafts in the Great Pyramid. And in one of the shafts, the southern shaft going from the Queen's Chamber, he discovered a little trapdoor some 55 meters from the chamber. It created a huge sensation. I was involved with Rudolf at the time.
Right.
There you are. You were asking why it has this effect. I remember when it was announced in the newspapers, it literally was syndicated around the world. I mean, like every single newspaper had it on the headlines.
Yeah.
It was a huge, huge reaction. Well, there was another attempt to open these doors by Dr. Hawass in 2002, and nothing came out of it because they found when they drilled the little hole through the Ganterbrück door, as you call it now.
This is like a little peek hole, wasn't it?
Yeah, they had a kind of peekaboo.
Yeah, exactly.
And they saw, to their surprise, about a meter away, another door.
Another door behind it, yeah.
Another door behind it. And they explored the northern shaft, the shaft on the other side, and they found a similar door resembling the Ganterbrück door. So the hopes are very, very high now of a major find. And we've been waiting and waiting for Dr. Hawass to finally decide to open these doors. You may have heard or seen a documentary series by History Channel lately called Chasing Mummies.
Yes.
Right. Well, in before the documentary, he was interviewed on ABC, I think, News. And he announced that before the end of the year, they're going to attempt again to open these doors. There is a team that is being led by Leeds University from England. It's an internationally mounted team. They're actually there at the moment with a new robotic machine. And they've said roughly before the end of the year, so let's hope they do it.
How big are the shafts, Robert?
let me explain the structure. The pyramid has three chambers. There is a so-called subterranean chamber under the pyramid. And then there are two chambers within the structure of the pyramid. One known as the Queen's Chamber or the Lower Chamber, and one known as the King's Chamber or the Upper Chamber. Now, from these two chambers emanate these shafts, two going north and two going south. Their opening is about 20 centimeters by 20 centimeters, 8 inches by 8 inches approximately.
Oh, geez, small.
Square openings. So obviously they couldn't have been used for... people to go through them.
Unless they were little people.
Very little people.
Yeah.
However, they rise at an incline, and it's been known since the 1960s. I've been part of the investigation in the 80s, that they are directed to star systems that were important for the ancient Egyptians. The ones in the south point to Orion's belt, like we said earlier. And one points to the star Sirius. And the northern ones point to the circumpolar stars, where you find the Big Dipper and the Small Dipper and the Drago constellation. Now, these were very, very important systems of stars that were part of the resurrection rituals of the pyramid builders. So the conclusion was that they were kind of symbolic paths or launching pads, if you like, to direct the soul of the king towards these star systems. The ones in the king's chamber actually shoot out of the pyramid. They actually go through the structure. The ones in the queen's chamber do not. And the mystery of these shafts in the queen's chamber is not only that they are blocked on the far end by these little doors, they were actually blocked at the entrance of the chamber. You couldn't actually see them. So it's a whole mystery. I mean, I can tell you, I've been discussing these shafts over the last 20 years with just about every expert you can imagine.
I wonder how thick do you think those doors might be? Be the door behind the door.
How thick?
Yeah.
They're about, well, if we judge from the first door, the Ganterbrig door, they're about 2.5-3 inches thick. They look like sliding doors. They seem to have been placed so that they were open at one stage and they were slid down like portcullis, like doors of a fortress, if you see what I mean.
Right.
And the idea of Gantenbrick, at least at the time, was to insert a plate, a very thin plate, under the gap of the door at the bottom, and try and lift the doors up again, rather than drill through them. But this hasn't been done. I'm not quite sure what the new team is going to do, but I have a feeling that they will probably drill again and pass a fiber optic camera and have a look and see what's on the other side.
And light it up. Now, the doors are made with what? What are they made from?
They're made, the whole structure of the pyramid is made of sandstone, or rather limestone, a much harder sandstone.
Yeah.
These doors are made of Chura limestone, which is very interesting because Chura limestone is not locally found at Giza. Oh, the whole the whole rough structure of the pyramid is made of the local limestone. When they build something that is of higher or more sacred meaning, such as a sarcophagus or a chamber, they use Chura limestone. Now, Chura limestone comes from the hills that are on the other side of the Nile in Cairo, known as the Mokattam Hills. The quarries are still there, by the way. I visited them not long ago. It's quite amazing. You can actually see the quarries of the pyramid builders.
I was going to say, you could see where things were cut out and dug out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they still use them. It's quite amazing. I mean, Egyptians are still quarrying at their ancient quarries. But anyway, that's what the doors are made of. They're made of Chura limestone, which implies a very sacred location. So,
that's a good point.
You know, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, it might be the greatest find ever, or as Ganterbrick was so fearful, nothing.
Well, you know? If for some reason they find something with this fiber optic camera that they stick through a hole, how are they going to ever go in there and get all that? Let's say they have tombs in there and sarcophaguses and artifacts. How are they going to go in there and get them?
Well, considering that it's taken nearly 15 years to just have a look what's behind,
yeah,
I think we can count on quite a few years before they start moving this stuff. But let me say that the only way to do this, short of dismantling the pyramid, would be to enter from the outside. That would require quite a lot of work. The doors are approximately 20 meters or so from the face of the pyramid.
Robert, we're going to take this break. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and talk more about that. I want to talk about the Hall of Records, your take on Mars and the tie-in with the pyramids, and also your latest work, Black Genesis. We'll be back.